So I'm going to be signing a national emergency.
Back in 2020, when the United States was told it had to close down its means of production and shut down its schools and shelter in place in order to come together to fight a virus, lawsuits were filed for breach of constitutional protections. Within the framework of these filings, the singular question burned into the consciousness of Americans all across the country. Why was federal and constitutional law ignored in the first place and set aside to allow mandates which hold no real power to prevail? And when certain states, like Pennsylvania, filed lawsuits for violations of established law, why were these lawsuits thrown out by federal judges who took an oath to protect the Constitution? Two women and their teams have discovered that what was being packaged and marketed as vaccines are actually biological weapons used to commit war crimes on the globe with a particular concentration on American lives. Sasha Latyapova, whose past professional experience in pharma and medical industries with a specific focus on development, validation, regulatory acceptance and commercialization of new clinical technologies, and Catherine Watt, who holds a philosophy degree from the University of Pennsylvania, spending her career as a paralegal researching constitutional law, working with human rights attorneys, were instrumental in helping to answer that burning question, why? These two women and teams of researchers, lawyers, scientists, and doctors have unpacked why constitutional and federal law was considered moot in the face of the making and distribution of what we are now being told are COVID-19 vaccines. At the forefront of these war crimes are the Department of Defense, the Department of Health and Human Services, and the U.S. Food and Drug Administration.
In 2005, the World Health Organization updated the international health regulations by adding language that included more surveillance and quarantine power, forced treatment of medical interventions power, and other language that supported the idea that national, state, and county or smaller localized governments would follow the guidelines and statutes laid out by the World Health Organization. This international health regulation has a long history. The earliest, most relevant piece of law was the language in the 1983 Public Health Emergencies Program inserted into the 1944 Public Health Service Act. It was under the Reagan administration that the Public Health Emergencies Program concentrated more power into the hands of the Health and Human Services Secretary whenever a public health emergency has been declared. Once they've declared it, the HHS Secretary is the only one who can suspend it. This closed loop is a concentration of power into the hands of an unelected individual. In fact, in April 2022, Biden appointed key leaders to work with HHS in implementing health practices for specific regions. This answers our question why federal and constitutional law was ignored and why lawsuits were stamped dismissed by federal judges. Under the Trump administration, Alex Azar, then Secretary of Health, and at the time of this production, Javier Becerra, the current Secretary of Health, hold more power than the U.S. Constitution itself. But it wasn't until 2020 that public health statutes and law started redefining public health in general and adopted terms like asymptomatic carrier and pre-communicable into their list of diagnoses. These arbitrary terms are not scientific, nor are they based on any health diagnostics or health-based trials. Simply put, these are terms that allow for a healthy person to be quarantined, isolated, force inoculated, recommended for surgery, or even experimented on, all in the name of public health.
Quarantining and isolating an individual has never really been part of public health history, at least not in the United States. but the long list of quarantine and isolation statutes under the National Conference of State Legislatures was updated in September of 2021 to include some severe quarantining and isolation language, and it does vary from state to state. Penalty for violating the quarantine or isolation orders as dictated by any health authority could be anywhere from a $5,000 fine for each infraction committed to incarceration, to a 2-year probation, to legal destruction of personal property. But what about the vaccines? Are they safe or effective? What's in them? How do we treat adverse reactions to them?
My name is Brooke Jackson. I was fired in September of 2020 for being a whistleblower.
In January of 2021, Brooke Jackson, working with Ventavia, a subcontractor of Pfizer, filed a lawsuit against Pfizer for violation of the Federal False Claims Act, which is a federal statute originally enacted in 1863 in response to defense contractor fraud during the American Civil War. Ms. Jackson's claim in the lawsuit is that she witnessed Pfizer defraud the U.S. government. This defrauding occurred through lack of oversight in the making and distribution of vaccines. The lack of coherent clinical trials, or any clinical trials for that matter, was particularly alarming to her. She assumed the U.S. government would want to know the company they were funding was failing every clinical trial, every safety regulation, and disregarding standard procedure for the transparency, safety, and efficacy of a COVID vaccine about to be distributed to 100 million Americans and the global population. Pfizer countered Ms. Brooks' lawsuit by stating in their motion to dismiss that they could not be defrauding the U.S. government because the U.S. government was already fully aware that there were no clinical trials or no safety protocols in the making of the COVID-19 injectable.
Within the motion to dismiss, Pfizer offered their evidence by producing a base agreement between the Department of Defense's Research and Technology Development Center, Advanced Technology International, and Pfizer. This base agreement is what's known as an Other Transaction Authority, or an OTA contract. Which states there was no legal obligation to conduct valid or clean clinical trials because the only goods and services being paid for by the U.S. government was for a large-scale manufacturing demonstration of a prototype. Other transaction agreements, or OTAs, are government contracts that eliminate protections for the public on pricing, access, and competition, including in connection with COVID vaccines and treatments. This means that if the women or men were to be made sterile or diagnosed with heart issues, autoimmune issues, cancer, or were to even die, no one would be responsible for these injuries or deaths. What we are essentially seeing is the use of other transaction authorities or even emergency use authorization as vehicles to undermine human rights or constitutional protections in the United States. An OTA is a special authority granted by Congress, which suspends oversight. Under the terms of the OTA, Pfizer had no obligation to even conduct a clinical trial. They could make the entire thing fraudulent. They could make it seem to be real with manipulable data, but it didn't have to be good data, and it didn't have to be in compliance with standard regulatory practices. Both the EUA and the OTA share the same flawed arrangement: lack of regulation, oversight, or proper practices to ensure the safety and efficacy of countermeasures, whether those measures be in the form of an injectable or even an instruction. It should also be noted that over $6 billion in funding for Operation Warp Speed went to a Department of Defense contractor, Advanced Technology International, or ATI, rather than with pharmaceutical companies directly. Within the framework of these contracts, all public records requests, like a Freedom of Information Act request, otherwise known as a FOIA request, and additional documents were exempt from public disclosure for 5 years.
As of 2019, the U.S. Department of Defense has 150 active Other Transaction Agreements, or OTAs, on its books, which combined have generated $5.8 billion in spending to date, according to a Bloomberg government analysis. With a combined ceiling value of $48 billion, these contracts represent key revenue streams for defense contractors and consortia, even if they generate only a fraction of that total over the next two decades. So is it a vaccine or not? It's not. It's a prototype. But what is a prototype? A prototype is a pre-product, a test to see if something actually works, or to see if the production of it is valid. It's just a test, not an actual end product. Prototypes are a means used in the process of developing something in a quick period of time to reach that end goal. The American people were lied to and told that these prototypes were safe and effective vaccines, when in actuality, no safety, no efficacy testing could even back up that statement.
Pfizer's extraordinary disclosure of the OTA government contract in response to Ms. Jackson's suit, labeling the vaccine as a large-scale manufacturing demonstration of a prototype, makes it clearer that the product is a countermeasure, or bioweapon, and not actually a pharmaceutical drug. Since it's a prototype product deployed by a military project rather than a pharmaceutical product, distributed for public health. In fact, in Ms. Latiapova's research of these contracts, she finds that DOD's own language repeats the term countermeasure frequently throughout. What is a countermeasure? It's a vaccine, right? Not at all. A countermeasure is a weapon. For instance, the Department of Defense will instruct the U.S. Army to deploy countermeasures to attack enemy combatants. The DOD has been pretty transparent that they are instructing their contractors, subcontractors, agents, defense contractors, and the pharmaceutical companies to deploy countermeasures, not vaccines, on the global population, with a particular concentration on U.S. citizens.
One of the worst proposals in U.S. history that reframed health and allowed these war crimes to continue was nearly 10 years ago. Around 2014, what we were told was a bipartisan effort to work on life-saving cures by advancing medical innovations turned out to be nothing more than a Trojan horse for the largest giveaway to the medical community ever seen in history. This was called the Cures Act. At the time of the Cures Act proposal, it had generated more lobbying than almost all the 11,000 bills together proposed during Congress at that time. At one point, it was suggested there were about 3 Cures Act lobbyists for every member of Congress. Instead of working on medical efforts to improve the health of Americans, what came out of the Cures Act was nothing more than a typical Washington deal, holding hostage some of the most basic health initiatives. Congress had to come together to do nothing more than pass a giant giveaway to drug companies. These giveaways include legalized off-label marketing fraud, repurposing drugs designed for one health issue and prescribing them for unrelated health issues without any evidence that this practice was safe or effective, hiding gifts or incentives that pharmaceutical companies give to doctors, shrugging off the fact that a major super PAC donation who would stand to benefit financially from pushing regenerative therapies through FDA, even if they don't meet the FDA's gold standard for safety and effectiveness. The Cures Act was never about health. It was simply about financializing human beings into experiments in order for the pharmaceutical companies to benefit. Despite over 100,000 public signatures on petitions calling for Congress to reject the Cures Act, it was passed anyway. Looking back to the signing of the 21st Century Cures Act, we can see how important it was for Congress to pass this. Not only was language inserted that further eroded human rights by removing informed consent, it makes it easier for the Department of Defense to contract with these pharmaceutical companies who are provided that extra layer of fraud protection covered under the Cures Act.
The Department of Defense controls the production of the prototype, or the countermeasure, from the very beginning. They have to be a part of every correspondence and on every phone call, CC'd in every email with any pharmaceutical company, their subcontractors, and any FDA regulators when it comes to the delivery of the COVID-19 injectable. As long as the DOD is in communications with these agencies are given immunity, protection from Freedom of Information Act requests, and possibly even signed non-disclosure agreements in order to protect themselves legally. When they keep the lack of oversight in the production and distribution of the prototypes, the ingredients of the prototypes, and the potential harms of the prototypes, from public knowledge. Essentially, the DOD is dictating to the FDA what the FDA must disclose to the public about the authorization of these allegedly safe vaccines. They have included language in their contracts with the pharmaceutical companies that no third party or independent testing site can be done on the prototypes. This means that no one really knows what is actually in the prototype vials. Nothing in the vials corresponds to what is on the labels. The only way we can find out what the properties are is by looking at the contents of the vials under a microscope, which no one is allowed to do, or assessing the damage these prototypes have done to injured or dead people. This is nothing more than the equivalent of a Frankensteinian experiment on human beings, and these prototypes, or what you've been told are vaccines, should absolutely be called countermeasures in the general population. Stop calling them vaccines. They are nothing more than toxic experiments the Department of Defense is conducting on the population. This is an anti-human, anti-life system, where the DOD is utilizing the same deployment methods as they would use to deploy a weapon on an enemy. But these weapons were simply labeled, or packaged, or marketed to the public as medicine or vaccines.
Why is Health and Human Services not stopping this? The HHS is supposed to make their decision to support the development of these prototypes on the basis of scientific data and evidence, if available. This is why the Department of Defense had to be involved in every form of communication with the FDA, pharmaceutical companies, and their subcontractors. They wanted to make sure that the scientific data would never be made available. The availability of data, or lack of it, is a key part of how the DOD not only controls the product itself, but also the key information about the product to regulators and to the HHS secretary. This arrangement between HHS, FDA, and the DoD was done in secret handshake agreements, and each agency is a knowing participant in the war crimes through non-disclosure of the dangers of what is being packaged as a vaccine. So why isn't the HHS stopping this? Why would they? They've been instructed by the DoD to keep it going and stand to benefit enormously by doing so.
These prototypes or countermeasures that human beings have been imbibing are nothing more than performance art. A sloppily put together package of anything from adjuvants, contaminants, wastewater, saline solution, or experimental technology like parasitic AI or inept mRNA. The truth is, no one really knows what's in the vials because that information, according to the Department of Defense, is classified. The clownish, over-the-top language of pressuring the public to take this garbage was so that pharmaceutical companies and their subcontractors and the various information apparatus surrounding this idea of a deadly pandemic could get paid. This chain of command theater was occupied by the good Germans and their bullshit jobs. But the price for this shoddy packaged performance art is an unimaginable horror, never before witnessed by the global population.
The excess mortality has shifted so much so that it's pretty phenomenal what you see here in the charts before you. This is not my data, this is the Society of Actuaries. In 2021, in ages 25 through 64, the employed people of our nation covered under group life, they experienced a 40% excess mortality. As quoted by a CEO of an insurance company, just a 10% increase in excess mortality is a 3-standard deviation event or a once in a 200-year flood, so 40 is off the charts.
Hundreds of thousands of innocent bodies have been disfigured as a result of the deployment of this countermeasure. Hundreds of thousands of innocent souls have left this planet, their bodies buried in too many graves to count. All for nothing more than false information and a terrorism campaign brought to you by the Department of Defense's own theater department through deployed performance art. Both Alex Azar and Javier Becerra deployed these countermeasures onto an unsuspecting and uninformed population based on this fraudulent arrangement these agencies had with each other and their collusion to knowingly keep the potential dangers of these prototypes from the public. Makes them complicit in these ongoing war crimes.
But looking back to 2020, the earliest signs of SARS-CoV-2 and the reactions and events that people were having in response to an alleged new novel pathogen presented more like a reaction to being poisoned rather than a reaction to a virus, novel or otherwise. Although some would argue that the Department of Defense's biological and germ warfare programs ended in 1969 and 1975 respectively, it's clear through the mechanism of these OTA contracts and other infectious disease functions and experiments, U.S.-funded lab-generated germ warfare is still very much alive, but has simply been rehomed through the Health and Human Services, the National Institute of Health, the CDC, and even the FDA, along with a myriad of other U.S.-backed and state-funded health and military agencies. It must be understood that the distribution of the poison, being branded as a virus, was not unleashed widespread through the air or water or sprayed on food. Rather, it was a very small portion of the population that was infected with this toxin. And each individual who had been poisoned presented different reactions to that poison. For instance, a healthy 20-something male is going to have a different reaction to being poisoned than a person whose body is weakened, say, from fighting cancer, or an elderly person. The majority of deaths in 2020 occurred, though, as a result of lockdown, neglect, abuse, and drug overdoses. And this happened as a result of practices and unconscionable demands made by public health authorities and their lackeys.
The new public health order that we're announcing will require San Franciscans to remain at home.
The majority of people did not die from a poison masquerading as a virus. Some people did die, but not millions as the media would have you believe. Perhaps the poison was distributed to a very small portion of the population through their 2019 flu shots. The bottom line is, though, no one is allowed to see originations of this poison masquerading as a virus. In fact, in one subpoena, the National Institute of Health presented over 200 blank or redacted pages as a response to this demand for inquiry. After all, Bob Redfield, the former head for the Centers for Disease Control, openly stated in 2020, it looked as though this virus had come out of a lab. Right after this statement was made, Mr. Redfield, a man whose entire career was dedicated to the study of infectious or airborne disease, was removed from his position as head of CDC and cut out of all future investigations into the allegedly novel pathogen.
It's hard to imagine this is how 2020 started. But across the world, dozens were falling ill with a mysterious virus that would ultimately change life as we know it.
Chinese health authorities are still working to identify the virus behind a pneumonia outbreak in the central city of Wuhan.
At least 59 people are believed to have been sickened by the new virus.
Tonight, U.S. airports on high alert, screening passengers for symptoms of a deadly new virus.
Very concerned. Now that you brought it to my attention, I'll stay away from most people wearing masks.
In January 2020, after the successful branding of a poison as a novel virus had commenced, and this branding was promoted ad nauseum in the media, Alex Azar, the head of Health and Human Services at the time, declared that the United States was indeed undergoing a public health emergency. 3 months later, on March 13th of 2020, former President Trump declared the national emergency. It was at this point the Department of Defense, Department of State, FEMA, and the HHS set to work conditioning the public to react to the terrorist labeled as SARS-CoV-2. These agencies did not treat the public as if we were experiencing a public health emergency. Rather, they treated the public as if we were at war. One indication of this wartime effort behavior was through the deployment of the Defense Production Act, or the DPA, which has only ever been utilized exclusively during wartime scenarios where all business and industry in the USA must be redirected away from the citizenry and the free market into the hands of the Defense Department to fight the war. These efforts are accepted willfully among the population, especially when messaging of nationalism and patriotism is branded through news feeds and promotions. For instance, during World War II, citizens were told it was their patriotic duty to melt their jewelry or personal items in order to make bullets for American soldiers fighting in Europe. or all steel in the United States was redirected to patch military planes or make tanks during this wartime effort. This same kind of busy work or patriotic wartime effort psychological tool, also known as the Defense Production Act, was deployed to support the idea that we all had to do our part to fight the enemy terrorist, the virus. But with the Department of Defense handing this wartime effort over to Health and Human Services, and with Health and Human Services holding the widest scope of power in history, why would they ever let things go back to normal? War crimes efforts include deploying billions of dollars out to commercials, entertainment, late-night talk shows, schools, marketing materials, public transportation posters, and every imaginable media corner in the United States was dedicated to the propaganda initiative to keep us all safe from a virus. This is also a method used in a war crime stage, and this method was simply the conditioning phase of the public. Conditioning the American public to feel empowered to follow their oppressor's orders is a not-so-subtle gaslighting technique. Another clue to identify an ongoing war crime are circulating stories that act as cover for the crime itself. Recently, the Great Resignation was trending. This term was the title of a story. The story goes that the professional workforce suddenly quit their jobs to travel or move around or find themselves. Although a small portion of the professional class did do this, they didn't do this on their own. Their behavior was modified, and they were influenced by the story. Through our analysis of the Q3 2021 findings, we were able to debunk this story through our recent video essay. What we established is that these employees weren't quitting. They were, in fact, dying off after imbibing the countermeasure, or they were becoming permanently disabled after imbibing the countermeasure. Now, there is a new story trending. This story is about how the well-paid employees in the FANG industries, including Twitter, are being laid off or fired. This, too, is cover for the great die-off, or the great disability, as a result of imbibing the countermeasures. Since this is a Department of Defense deployment of a weapon on the enemy, also known as citizens of all stripes, we will see lots of stories that will provide cover for ongoing war crimes.
What happens now? Obviously, the public is onto the scam, sees this as a fraud, and it's over, right? We can all go back to normal, right? No. Now that the public has been sufficiently gaslit and conditioned or tenderized into a behavioral change, there will be no need for multi-billion-dollar marketing or ad campaigns in the future. Especially when Javier Becerra, or any future Secretary of Health and Human Services, announces the next public health emergency. It's expected that the population was trained into obedience and will simply comply with more lockdown, quarantine, isolating, masking, testing, and even vaccinating when a public health crisis is announced. In other words, on those statutes listed in the quarantine and isolation protocols set forth by the NCSL, you won't be incentivized with free donuts or enticed with special compensation for following the soft power orders of your representative or your favorite cartoon character. It will simply come out as a notice from your local health authority, who will take orders from the Biden appointee, also unelected, and if you don't comply, there will be consequences. These are the tactics criminals use when waging war crimes. They often engage with the public through soft power techniques the first time around, but the next time, their technique won't be so nice. given this enormous concentration of power and all your constitutional and civil rights protections have been handed over to a dictator and his agency, Health and Human Services, don't expect there to be any velvet-gloved orders in the future.
On October 13, 2022, Javier Becerra, the current Secretary of Health and Human Services, has announced that we are still in a health emergency, and it doesn't look like this is ending anytime soon. The health crisis will still exist, even though no national emergency has been declared by the White House officially since February 18, 2022. It's important to know the distinction between the health secretary announcing a public health emergency and the White House announcing a national emergency. The national emergency opens up a funding stream for businesses across the country. The health emergency opens up power grabs. In fact, the public even witnessed Biden announce that the pandemic is over. But just because the White House announces that the pandemic is over does not mean the war crimes will suddenly cease. In fact, twice Biden promised he would cement the national emergency into the National Register. And on February 18, 2022, he finally made good on his threat, essentially making the national emergency for COVID response a long-term, if not continual, order embedded into our existence. As of the date of this recording, the public attention has been diverted with the theater of the midterm election and the story of Sam Bankman-Fried, ignoring the very real concentration of power into the hands of a single unelected agency, the Department of Health and Human Services. Rather than Twitter wars arguing about whether there was a red wave or a blue wave, or what sort of regulatory investigation should go into a crypto agency that defrauded billionaires, we should be preparing for military tribunals and convictions of the hundreds of thousands of players who have participated in war crimes against an innocent population.
The structural features, laws, and language Congress built into this concentration of power are a breathtaking indictment not only to the precise method of building this power structure itself, but also on a lazy, uninformed public who seem to be incapable of intuition and even question their own experiential knowledge, which could guide them safely into self-preservation. But blaming the public for their own oppression isn't quite fair when the Department of Defense is behind the deployment of a countermeasure in order to reset the population into thinking a different way or behaving a different way when it comes to autonomous existence. And when that countermeasure takes human life at such a scale, obviously they are going to invest an enormous amount of funding into convincing the public to accept the countermeasure. Can't we just convince our members of Congress to stop this? To veto it? If it's war crimes, surely Congress will exercise their powerful positions and file lawsuits or open investigations, right? A key factor that must not be ignored, and which answers the question at the beginning of all this, how did constitutional law become impotent in the face of human rights violations in an allegedly free country, is that Congress actually eliminated their own oversight power while inserting law which concentrates all power to one single dictator, who at this moment is Javier Becerra. Ultimately, what Congress achieved is the shredding of the Constitution once and for all by reversing hundreds of years of protections in a document that represents a simple American standard that all humans are to be treated with dignity and all humans are free. So no, Congress is one of the key players in the war crimes. It's hardly realistic to believe that they would reverse them.
So as of right now, the HHS secretary can suspend all law in the name of public health anytime he wants, with zero intervention from the very members of Congress we allegedly just voted into office to protect us from such power grabs. Congress has eliminated their own power to intervene in any public health regulation that might be a war crime. Also added into these structural congressional features is that no federal judge can even review these declarations, let alone override them, leaving them solely within the power of the HHS's discretion. This means there is no judicial review, and no states can wield any state power or even file lawsuits to undermine or even review or question the dictates of the HHS.
Apparently, people aren't aware of these structural features that Congress built into the law around public health, because lawsuits have been filed anyway. Almost all of them have been dismissed, or if a judge finds in favor of the plaintiff, the defendant will naturally appeal that decision. At this point, it's theater and a way to generate false hope to the masses, as in the case of George Borrello et al. Versus Governor Hochul. The judge found in favor of Borrello and assessed that Governor Hochul doesn't have the right to put New Yorkers in quarantine camps. But Hochul never had the right to put New Yorkers into quarantine camps in the first place. And based on those structural features that Congress placed into public health law, the judge didn't have the power or the right to make that ruling either. The legislation Hochul spoke about, which caused such an uproar, can only be reversed by the Secretary of Health and Human Services. All power around public health law, which includes quarantining and isolating the public, has been handed over to the HHS Secretary. Until the HHS Secretary stops announcing that we are in a public health crisis, or until the Health and Human Services Department is completely dismantled and all the tentacles that operate under the purview of its dictate are undermined once and for all, the war crimes, power grabs, and human rights violations outside of due process will continue. Again, since January 2020, the U.S. government has lied to the American people and the world's people about the outbreak of SARS-CoV-2 and the lawfulness, safety, and effectiveness of government-directed measures to address the fraudulent national emergency. Under the lie that a national emergency exists and the corollary lie that duly executed laws have authorized absolute concentration of power in the federal executive branch, the U.S. government has attempted to suspend the U.S. Constitution and all federal and state laws, constitutions, legislatures, and courts capable of blocking the systemic military medical martial law atrocities they have committed to date and are attempting to render permanent.
You are witnessing ongoing legalized, carefully crafted, secretive, protected war crimes. Not only has the U.S. Constitution been rendered impotent and ineffective, cunningly replaced with the 1944 Public Health Service Act, but you're witnessing in real time a reversal of basic human rights and moral freedoms. You're witnessing the reversal of Nuremberg trials. For in the Nuremberg trials, those doctors and civil servants who were found guilty were hung by the neck till dead. When you hear people say, "We never want to see the atrocities of the Holocaust repeated in the modern age," they aren't talking about the death camps, experiments on humans, and human rights violations and outright murder. What they are saying is, we must draft legislation, craft scenarios, and cement contracts to protect war criminals from ever having to face the gallows again.